Good evening. If you were here this morning, then you'll understand that I'm a little paranoid about putting on my glasses. I hope you'll forgive me, but I'm blind otherwise. Psalms, the 88th Psalm, 88th Psalm is the Psalm that's been relegated to me this time. I keep getting the good ones. This is quite an interesting psalm. I'll read it to you first, and then we're going to go through it. But I'll just warn you up front, it's not a picker-upper, okay? So let's go through it and see what happens. A song, a psalm of the sons of Korah for the director of music, according to the Mahalath Leonath, I never figured out how to say that, a maskil of Heman Dezrahite. O Lord, the God who saves me, day and night I cry out before you. May my prayer come before you. Turn your ear to my cry. For my soul is full of trouble and my life draws near the grave. I am counted among those who go down to the pit, and I am like a man without strength. I am set apart from the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more and who are cut off from your care. You have put me in the lowest pit, in the darkest depths. Your wrath lies heavily upon me, and you have overwhelmed me with all your waves, Selah. You have taken from me my closest friends, and you have made me repulsive to them. I'm confined and cannot escape. My eyes are dim with grief. I call to you, O Lord, every day. I spread out my hands to you. Do you show your wonders to the dead? Do those who are dead rise up and praise you? Selah. Is your love declared in the grave? Your faithfulness in destruction? Are your wonders known in the place of darkness, or your righteous deeds in the land of oblivion? But I cry to you for help, O Lord. In the morning my prayer comes before you. Why, O Lord, do you reject me and hide your face from me? From my youth I have been afflicted, close to death. I have suffered your terrors, and I am in despair. Your wrath has swept over me. Your terrors have destroyed me. All day long they surround me like a flood. They have completely engulfed me. You have taken my companions and loved ones from me. The darkest darkness is my closest friend. You know, I always expect the Psalms for some reason to end on a good note. I always think it's going to come, at the end it's going to say, yeah, but God, you're going to come through and everything's good. But this one just, this is a psalm of somebody that is in torment in their own spirit. And so we're going to talk a little bit about this and how we can apply this to us. This is one of 13 psalms that start out at the beginning that say something about a maskil of somebody, okay? So it says maskil. Now, this word maskil is one of those weird words that nobody knows what it means, not really, because they try to apply it. And if you look at the different psalms that have this, Psalm 32, 42, 44, 45, 52, 53, 54, 55, 74, 78, 89, 142, plus this one, that makes 13. And if you went through all of them, you'd find I've forgotten which one it is, 42, 44, someplace in there, it's a love song, you know. It's totally different. It's not about death and destruction or anything. So it's not about that. And so it's left people to come with this idea that a maskil is a contemplation. So these are called the contemplation psalms. And so it's a thinking psalm. It's something that you're supposed to look at, and it's supposed to affect your mind and make you think. Okay? At least that's the best thought that they could come up with. Some people say contemplation, others instruction, some say it's for learning. I remember Jim telling me about Ewald, and I don't even know who Ewald is other than Ewald, but that's all the commentaries always just say, according to Ewald, and I'm like, okay, I'm pretty good, but I don't care. But anyways, according to Ewald, it's, you know, and Ewald suggests that it's a musical term denoting a melody requiring great skill in its execution. But Psalm chapter 47, verse 7 says that, let me read it. Right. Psalm 47, verse 7. I can get to it. It says, for God is the king of all the earth. Sing to him a psalm of praise. And I wanted that last part where it says of praise is probably better written of understanding or something like that, but it's the same word. It's the maskil. It's exactly the same word. So it's the idea of understanding a thought. And so this is intended for us to take it to heart. At least that's the way I understand it. And so let's look at this in a way that we can actually apply this something to us to give us some kind of instruction in our heart. And that's how I'm going to approach it. In verses 1 and 2, we have, in the very beginning of it, it says, O Lord, the God who saves me, day and night I cry out before you. May my prayer come before you. Turn your ear to my cry. The first thing I'll notice is this, is that he recognizes that God is great, what God has done for him. It starts out, it says, O Lord, your God, the God who saves me. This is an idea, and most of the commentaries and most of the things, and I understand why they say it. It's this idea that a recognition that God is able because of what he's seen in the past. I've seen what God has done. I know how God is good. I know where God has taken me in the past. And a hopefulness that same God is able to affect my future. Sometimes I forget about this, and it's easy for me to get kind of sidetracked, you know, and I forget. And I see, I'll say, God, I saw what you did before. Why aren't you ever going to do anything for me in the future? And I go immediately into a hopelessness. But this psalm seems to appear to apply a hopefulness, the idea that you are the God that saves. Okay? He doesn't understand how or why this is happening or what's going to happen to save him, but he recognizes that God is the one who has the power to save. Second of all, it's not a vengeful type psalm. You know, just nowhere near does he say, and destroy all my enemies, you know. And now David liked to do that, like in Psalm 54 or 5, he says, let evil recoil on those who slander me, or in your faithfulness destroy them. Nowhere in there is he trying to blame somebody and say, okay, these people are bad, go out there and take care of them. It's not what he's about. This psalm is about me. It's about his soul. And the way he is. And the last thing I will say about verses 1 and 2 is it says, turn your ear to my cry. And this is the idea that whenever it talks about this, it ends in the part that says, right before it says, day and night I cry out before you. Turn your ear to me. Listen, day and night I cry out. This is something that he is doing constantly. It's always in his heart. But that idea of crying out to the Lord is the same phrase that's used in Psalm chapter 47, verse 1, where it says, shout to the Lord with cries of joy. It's the idea of God. You know, you could be going, yay, or you could be going, ah. Either way, it was the idea of a desperateness of reaching towards God and wanting, saying, God, hear my prayer. Hear what I'm about to write and about what we sing. You know, I find it interesting, and this is kind of a little side note, that whenever we're talking about this, that this is a psalm, right? So it's not like a poem that I write for myself and I keep it on my, you know, I put it on my mirror or whatever like that so I can remember it kind of a thing. This is something that I write and put in our songbook, right? This is something that it's meant not just for Heman, or however you say his name, the person that's actually writing this, but this is intended to be passed on to other people so that they can understand his feeling and apply it to themselves. And so this is something that we can apply for ourselves. So verses 3 through 5. And first thing you'll notice is that in verse 3 it says, for my soul is full of trouble. He's not talking, even though later on he talks in a way that almost sounds like he might have an affliction of like leprosy or something. I think it's not ever intended to be a physical thing. This guy, he is in affliction in his soul, down deep inside of him. He feels the weight as he goes forward in his day. And it's reflected in other places, like in Psalm chapter 22. It has a similar type feel to it. This idea that I'm hopeless in my soul, in my heart of hearts. The second thing you'll notice is that the part where it says in verse, verse 5, where it says, I'm counted among those who, let me read it. For my soul is full of trouble and my life draws near the grave. I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I'm like a man without strength. I'm set apart with the dead, like the slain who lay in the grave, whom you remember no more and who are cut off from your care. The second thing I wanted to point out is that part where it says that I am set apart with the dead. The New English translation puts it like this. I am adrift among the dead. It's like I've been cast down in a place where I am actually, I'm a live person with dead people all around me. Now, how many of you have ever watched any of these zombie movies? You like zombie movies? Okay, so I'm, you know, what is it, World War Z and all those kind of good things, right? So they have all these zombie movies, and there's always this handful of people, and their whole job is to stay away from the dead people. Right? That's what he feels like. He's adrift among dead people. And he's got the zombies around him, and he just wants to get out. Watch one of those shows. You'll know this feeling right here. And the last thing is, in verse 3, it says, he also points out, he says, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you cut off and you remember no more. Now, I don't think he meant in this that God was like, ah, la, 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 I'm not here, not listening. You know, God wasn't trying to say, I don't remember, I don't want to hear you, I don't want to do anything. But he was saying, this is how I feel. And I've been there. I've been to that place where down deep in my soul, I feel like I'm lost. And as we go, you'll get to feel this even more, I think, in this idea of being hopeless. I'm dead inside. And I just don't know what to do about it. I'm adrift with dead people. I just feel like I pray to you, but sometimes it's like I don't know if you even hear me. We've been there. And we've been able to recover from it and come through with God. But this is a real feeling, and I want you to feel it if you can. Verses 6 through 7. 6 and 7 says, you have put me in your lowest pit, in the darkest depths. Your wrath lies heavily upon me. You have overwhelmed me with all your waves. And then it says, so you've put me in the lowest pit. I don't know exactly how to put this, but the way I read it and the way I understand it is it's like I've been judged and I've been found wanting. That's kind of the, and oddly enough, this is not necessarily have to be true in the real sense. So whether God actually looked down and said, no, I'm cutting you off, or the fact that he felt like that, it doesn't matter. I heard this, and I've said this before, that somebody told me one time, he said, you know, in America, we like to have everything, all our ducks in order, everything's, we're very analytical. And I think most people say, yeah, especially men, you know, and I'm an engineer, so I like to do that kind of stuff. Everything's like, everything's right. So if somebody comes up and says, what's 1 + 1? It's 2. Boom, end of story. Nobody comes up. If my kids ever came up to me and said, Dad, 1 + 1 is 3, I'd be going, okay, maybe we need to go see a psychiatrist, you know. We need to do something about this. Let's do some math. Okay, I've got a matchstick here. I've got 2 pennies. I'd do something because 1 + 1 is never 3. But I want you to think about this. And you have to wrap your brain around it. If you honestly think 1 + 1 = 3, for you, 1 + 1 will always equal 3. Okay? Are you right? Well, it doesn't matter if you're right. It has nothing to do with whether or not you're right. All it has to do is for you, it will be true. For us, we go around in our head believing things lots of times, and it doesn't matter what is good and what's bad. It doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. It doesn't matter whatever. If it's in his head and it believes it, it will be true. I remember there's a teacher at Oklahoma Christian named Lynn McMillan. I don't know how many have heard of him. I know our kids have all taken classes with Lynn McMillan. I took classes with Lynn McMillan whenever I was back there. His son is now a teacher, and I think his grandson is actually doing something now there at the school, and they're still, Lynn McMillan still teaching. Well, when I was there, he and his wife were both counselors. They were like psychologists. They were big. They wrote books. You can probably still go out there and find their books someplace. Very smart people. And this whole idea of thinking this way, I've kind of got off now. I'm trying to describing Lynn McMillan. I can't remember. Oh, yeah, I remember what it was. So he and his wife, I remember him telling me this so clearly, telling the class that he and his wife, they had, she thought one thing and he thought the other. And they, being psychologists, they argue, you know, intellectually. So they can both say, no, I'm right, dear, you're wrong. And it doesn't hurt the other one's feelings. Right. But anyways, so they were able to say that, hey, I'm right, I'm wrong, I'm whatever, you know. And so they would argue about this, and both of them were always giving the other one a hard time. No, you think this, and no, you think that, you know, and they're both going back and forth. And he said that it was some years they had been doing this for a long time, and it got to be almost a joke, and they'd get to arguing, until one day they were arguing like this, and he realized that they'd switched sides. That the one that was saying A was saying B now, and the one that was saying B is saying A, and they'd actually switched sides and they were still arguing. Why? It's because if it's in your head, then it's going to be real to you. Sometimes I get guilty of blaming other people, saying, well, what's wrong with you? Can't you just figure this out? Can't you understand this? And maybe they can't. We have to understand that people sometimes just can't wrap their heads around things that are godly, that are right, that are whatever you want to call it. We just can't do it. I think that we can actually fool ourselves into thinking that we're always right just because we think we're doing things right. That's why it's so important whenever we're doing this thing with this minister search and anything that we do, that we step back out of it. Where it's no longer Eddie that's making the decisions. I have to step back out of it and turn it over to the will of God. Oswald Chambers, his thing that my utmost for his highest is, he was talking about this idea that of habits. He did this the other day. He was talking about having habits. The habit of having no habits, I think, is how it was entitled. And this whole idea is that I can get into a habit of doing something. Okay, I get in the habit of doing something every day until finally I'm doing it. It may have started out good, may be good, whatever. The habit of having no habits is the habit of being able to say that I will go plan to go this way, but God, you direct. So that if I start walking this way and he leads me that way, I can't go I can't go that way because I'm going this way. We've got to take it out of our head and let God be God. As we often say, let go and let God. We have to let him do it. Verses 6 and 7. Moving on. You have put me in the lowest pit. Your wrath lies up heaven. Is this where I started? This is where I was already starting on this. No, this is 3 and 5. That's what I did. Okay, you put me in the lowest pit, in the darkest depths. Your wrath lies heavily upon me. You have overwhelmed me with all your waves. Selah. And so it ends up here in the end, in this little part, and he gets to Selah, means I'm going to take a rest. I like this idea almost. Okay, he's going, oh, this is bad, this is bad. And he steps back and he rests just for a second. Then he gets up, and then he goes a little bit more, and he steps back and he rests for a minute. And you can see kind of a break in there as he rests between pains. You have put me in the lowest pit, perceived recognition of God's judgment. Your wrath lies heavily on me. This is to me, I take this as a deep sense of his sinfulness. God's wrath, this idea of God's wrath, the wrath of God, this actually means, it's an interesting word here in the Hebrew, because first of all, it's plural. So it says the wraths of God, if you will. And the second thing is that the actual word used for anger or wrath or whatever is fires. It's like the fires of God, the burning hatred, you know how people turn red and steam comes out their head on the cartoons and stuff like that? That fire that's in somebody, you know, the wrath of God is so intense that it says that who can even stand this, right? You have overwhelmed me with your waves. And then he takes a break. Selah. And we move on to verses 8 through 9.5. You've taken from me my closest friends. You've made me repulsive to them. I'm confined and cannot escape. My eyes are dim with grief. So in verses 8 and 9, it says, a great sense of loneliness, isolation has come over him. That's one of the problems with being in the pit, right? One of the problems with being in the pit is this sense of isolation. Now, I've seen these shows where people fall down into pits. And they're down there in the pit, and they can look up there, and they can see a light way up there. And they call, help! And they just keep calling until their throat is sore, and they can't call anymore, right? And their whole time is, maybe somebody up there will hear me. And yet in their heart, what are they feeling? They're all alone. They're in the pit. There's no hope. They can't get out. And this is the feeling that we get in this idea is that you have put me in the lowest pit. Your wrath lies heavily upon me is another thing he says, and we already talked about that. Sorry, I need a pen so I can mark off where I'm at. This idea of loneliness also carries with it this idea of a good way of thinking about it is leprosy. This idea of leprosy, when you're out you're outside the gates and people are throwing food down to you, you're isolated down there all by yourself. You can't even do anything. This hopelessness is what he's feeling because of this torment in his soul. It says, Spurgeon puts it this way, the wrath of God is the very hell of hells, and it weighs upon the conscience of a man. And when it weighs upon the conscience of a man feels torment such as only that of a damned spirit, that of damned spirits can exceed. Sorry, I'm butchering that. But the wrath of God is the very hell of hells, and when it weighs upon the conscience, a man feels a torment such as only that of damned spirits can exceed. I've been there. I know what it's like to feel like God is angry with me. And to feel that hopelessness and that pain that comes along with this isolation of not having my God. And this is something that this man is feeling right now. Verses 9b through 12, he says this. I call to you, O Lord, every day. I spread out my hands to you. Do you show your wonders to the dead? Do those who are dead rise up and praise you? Is your love declared in the grave, your faithfulness and destruction? And this is really not about whether or not you're going to go to hell. I mean, whether or not there is a God. Sorry. It's not about whether or not there's a God. He's not like, God, do you hear me? Are you not? Are you even there? Now, sometimes I felt that way. But that's not really what he's saying, I don't think. He's feeling that same feeling that I felt before. That I say, okay, I'm baptized and I'm a good man and I try to do what God wants. And then I get caught in these sins and I get this pain in my soul. And I start thinking, you know, if I die today, I'm going to hell. This feeling that, God, can you even hear me? Do I have any hope at all? It's a doubt of salvation, a doubt of will I be lost forever. We're getting towards the end. Verses 13 through 15, it says, But I cry to you for help, O Lord. In the morning my prayer comes before you. Why, O Lord, do you reject me and hide your face from me? From my mouth I have been afflicted and close to death, and I have suffered your terrors, and I am in despair. One thing I'd like to note right off is that it says he seeks God in the morning. And I thought that's interesting because he starts out from the very earliest moment of his day, from the time he first wakes up, and he starts looking for God. He starts wondering. This is a pain that is hourly, daily, minute by minute that's with him. And from the very moment he gets up, he starts asking God, okay, God, what can I do? And he does it in his morning prayers. Please, God, and I encourage you to have morning prayers, a time in the morning, whenever you can turn to God and just say, God, work with me today. If nothing else, just have a few minutes that you have that you can talk with God. Make it a habit, but it's a good one to have. And so he's doing this where he gets down there and he just says, every morning I ask, and yet, God, you hide your face from me. And my question for that is, why does God hide his face? I'm not going to answer that one. But it's something for you to think about. From my youth I have been afflicted, close to death. I have suffered your terrors. I am in despair. And finally, he ends up in the last part. Last scripture says in verses 16 through 18, your wrath has swept over me. Your terrors have destroyed me. All day long they surround me like a flood. They have completely engulfed me. You have taken my companions and loved ones from me. The darkness is my closest friend. I like this idea. We were talking about the wrath of God, the heat, you know, and everything like that. I was talking about this also in this. I was thinking that I remember my dad. My dad was one of these guys that was always hot. Okay, he'd go outside when it could be pouring sleet or snow. It could be whatever. My dad was always hot. And he sweated like a pig. But anyways, that's another subject. He had this. He was just one of these kind of guys. And I remember him saying that right after I was born, my granddad had moved back to Oklahoma. And so right after I was born, we took a trip to Oklahoma and we moved to Oklahoma. Okay? We lived in Oklahoma for, I don't even know how long, 6 months maybe, something like that. And my dad went back there because he thought he could find a job, and he couldn't find a job. So he turned around and they drove back. Okay? So he got a job and up in Marin County, up in above San Francisco. They moved up to San Rafael, and so they drove there right after I was born, and they drove back while my mom was pregnant with my sister, and she's less than a year older than me, okay? Just that tells you anything. And I remember him saying about how they were driving through the desert, and just that intense heat, and he got to a hotel. They stopped at a place because he just couldn't drive anymore, you know, and he got there, and they stopped in this hotel, and this hotel doesn't have air conditioning. Okay, in the desert. Now imagine that. Nowadays, it's not even, you know, it's never going to happen, right? But back then, that was likely to happen. Can you imagine? How many of you like to sleep when it's hot? Okay, I see a lot of heads like going like this, right? Nobody likes to sleep. It's bad to sleep whenever it's cold, but at least I can put like extra blankets on me or something like that. Though I tell you, if I had to sleep in the cold without blankets, I think that'd be just as much torment. But when it's hot, there is just no comfort. When I feel that God is angry with me and God is against me, what can comfort me? What can comfort me? I couldn't think of anything, because that is my comfort, is God. And so I turn to God and I ask God, and God says, I don't hear anything. Or in my heart of hearts, I think he's rejecting me, then either one, I'll have no comfort. It says the psalmist repeats his feelings of being overwhelmed right there, and it ends in a line that probably some of you have heard before. Hello, darkness, my old friend. I think this is a common way of thinking. Sometimes darkness is your friend. That's where you are. Can't find anything else, and so you
you find comfort in the fact that if nothing else, I'm just here. Darkness, my old friend.
So I could relate to his writings. I could relate with what he's talking about. But I don't want to end right there, because for us, we don't have to end there. And I don't think he had to either, and he probably didn't. Some of the things, just a note also, I didn't say this before, but just to let you know, that Haman, however you say his name, the Ezrahite, it talks about him several times in the Bible, actually, assuming it's the same person. In 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 31, it talks about his great wisdom. Several places in Chronicles, it talks about his musical ability and his service that he does. In 1 Chronicles 25, it talks about his many and exceptional sons. He had many sons, and they were apparently quite exceptional children, which is something I think that gives any father some pride and happiness. It also talks in 1 Corinthians chapter 25, verse 6, about his service to the king, that he was somebody who actually had the ear of the king, and he was at the service of the king. So he's not a man that, we're not talking about a man that doesn't know God. We're talking a man who either before these things were written, found God, came out of the despair and was pulled up out of the pit, or he's a man that found later on something happened to him that caused him to become desperate and away from God. I don't know which. But we're talking about a man that knew God and knew the things of God. One of the things I was going to say about the pit, it's interesting how pits work. You get down in a pit, there is literally nothing you can do to get out. And yet, it seems to me that most people, their solution is to dig deeper. You ever notice that? If I get in that pit of despair, of hopelessness, of helplessness, of this insanity of thinking that I can't do anything, what do? Is I tend to dig deeper. But the first step is just between you and me. The first step is to stop digging, and the second one is to let God put down a ladder or a rope or whatever you want to call it. That's my only hope to get out. I can do nothing. If you are in this despair of a deep pit, there is only one solution. And it's to let go and let God do it. Quit digging. A couple things I just want to point out. Paul felt this, I think, to a certain extent whenever he was asking God and his whatever he was tormented by. I don't know what it was that he had. It doesn't say in 2 Corinthians. But in verse 12, in chapter 12, verse 8, it says, three times I pleaded, I begged the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Now, if he had stopped right there, I'd say, man, this is Haman all over again, or Haman, however you say his name. You know, that's him all over again. But it goes on to say, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, and in difficulties. For when I am weak, that's when I am strong. We don't have to stay in the pit. We have a solution. The second thing is that God disciplines his children. In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 4, it says, the struggle against sin you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And have you completely forgotten this word of encouragement that addresses you as a father addresses his son? Okay, first of all, I just want to point out, it says, in the struggle against sin, you have not yet had to resist to the point of shedding your blood. What he was saying is, oh, you think it's bad now? You think it's bad now? Just wait. Okay? He's not giving them encouragement here. He's not here sitting here and saying, oh, you don't have to worry. Everything's good in the future. He's saying, no, you guys haven't even gotten to the worst part. So what does he keep going? It says, my son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline and do not lose heart when he rebukes you. Because the Lord disciplines the ones he loves. He chastens everyone he accepts as his son. The other thing I had too is in, I didn't put it down, but in, I know what happened. In Matthew chapter 6, and the Sermon on the Mount, as many of you know, is my go-to scriptures, one of my go-to places in the Bible, because I find it's got this infinite amount of wisdom that to me I need, I go to all the time. And he gets to this point and it says, in beginning verse 19, it says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy, where thieves do not break in, do not steal, for there your treasure will be. There, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light." That's a great scripture. Sometime we'll have to go back over it again. "But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. And when the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" Notice where he's gone back to. Hello, darkness, my old friend. "No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other. He'll be devoted to the one, despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." Now, if you just stop there and you go, okay, now my scripture, my Bible right here has a break right there. So that part's all just by itself. So if you just stop there and you go, okay, now let's study this part. And then next week we'll go to verse 25 and following. You're going to miss the story. Because it starts, it says, "Therefore, I tell you not to worry about what it is that you have. Don't worry about your food. Don't worry about your how many of you can add an inch to your height just because by worrying? Tell me, what does worrying ever do for you? I sit here, I worry about things all the time. Oh, I worry, you know, I don't have money to pay this bill. Have you ever been there before? You know, I know I owe the IRS money. I just don't have the money, so I'm going to avoid their phone calls." Right? How many times has that gotten things better for you? Right? Worrying about, oh no, it's the IRS, I'm not going to answer that call, doesn't get you anywhere. Worry never solves an issue. And in the end it says, he goes through and he says, so what are you going to do? If your treasures are in heaven, what are you going to worry about here on earth? What? There is nothing to worry about here on earth. There is nothing that you have to worry about. So you sit here and go, yeah, but I have to have money to eat food. Why? What do you care? Just get up in the morning, do what you're supposed to do, go where God leads you, and God will take care of you. Well, that's not what it really means, because I've seen the hobos down on Hope, you know, and we don't call them hobos anymore, do we? The homeless people. I've seen them. You know, they get up and they say, well, I don't want to have a place to live. I want to live under a tree, you know. Well, they're no good. I don't want to be like them. You won't be like them if you trust in God. And if you are like them, you're still trusting in God. Quit worrying about your food. Quit worrying about, I mean, I do it. Don't get me wrong. I'm right here. I'm speaking to myself as much as I'm talking to you guys. Because, you know, I need a good job. I need this. No, I don't. Let go and let God. What do I need? I need to have a place to go when I die. That's what I need. End of story. Right? Think about it. If I have some place to go when I die, then what I have here makes no difference. In the end, it says that, therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. I'm going to end with this. Oswald Chambers. I think this is March 12th. Is utmost for my highest. It's called God's Total Surrender to Us. The scripture that is given is, "For God so loved the world that he gave." And you can finish the sentence, right? John 3:16. Salvation does not mean merely deliverance from sin or the experience of personal holiness. The salvation which comes from God means being completely delivered from myself and being placed with perfect union, into perfect union with Him. When I think of my salvation experience, I think of being delivered from sin and gaining personal holiness. But salvation is so much more. It means that the Spirit of God has brought me into intimate contact with the true person of God Himself. And as I am caught up into this total surrender to God, I become thrilled with something infinitely greater than I am, than myself. To say that we are called to preach holiness or sanctification is to miss the point. We are called to what? What are we called to do? Proclaim Jesus Christ. That's what we're called for. All the other stuff, well, let me finish reading. The fact that He saves from sin and makes us holy is actually part of the effect of His wonderful and total surrender for us. If we are truly surrendered, we will never be aware of our own efforts to remain surrendered. Now, this is complicated, so you got to think about this one. If we are truly surrendered, we will never be aware of our efforts to remain surrendered. Our entire life will be consumed with the one to whom we surrender. Okay? Think about that. Beware of talking about surrender if you know nothing about it. Just warning you. If, in fact, you will never know anything about it until you understand that John 3:16 means that God completely and absolutely gave Himself to us. In our surrender, we must give ourselves in the same way to God as He gave Himself to us. Totally, unconditionally, and without reservation. The consequences and circumstances resulting from our surrender will never enter our mind, because our life will be totally consumed with Him. Whenever you go, I got to thinking then about the children of Israel being taken into captivity with the Babylonians, you know, and they went there. Now, I'm not saying they didn't think about God and stuff like that, but they went there. They were part of the people. That's what they were. Okay, they were Israelites living in Babylon. End of story. They didn't sit here and start saying, oh, I got up this morning, okay, now I'm going to walk outside by the... Oh, no, I can't because I'm stuck in Babylon. They didn't have to think about it. They got up, they didn't run down to the market and buy their kosher food that they normally did, like however they used to do it. They did it the way that they do it now. The children of Israel, when they left Egypt and they got across the desert and they're out in the middle of the desert, and they said, oh, we don't want this. We want to go back. I'm going, what? You don't get it. You don't get to go back. It's not one of those things where you get to go back to anything. You are people of God now in the desert. So where are you going to be? I like this. I grew to appreciate this psalm. But I grew to partly because I can understand it. Have you been to that pit before? Have you felt that despair? Have you felt the loneliness that comes with being isolated, or at least thinking you're isolated? Have you had the mind games that told you something and then you found out later that it was just Eddie? And I needed to let it go. So I would encourage you to remember that we're not a people stuck. You don't have to stay in the bottom of the pit. You don't have to stay even where you are right now. Even if you think, oh, I'm not in a pit. Everything's good right now. You don't have to stay where you are right now even. There's better things for you. But you have to let go. And you have to let God. This is all stand and sing.